CBS Eye on the World. Malcolm Holine, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations. Join me. I'm John Batchelor, and we welcome Hussein Abdul Hussein of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, who's going to help us understand immediately one of the mysteries of the Middle East these last years, Yemen. Malcolm?
Yes. Jake Sullivan, the National Security Council advisor to the president, said that this week's trip, which includes his deputy, Brett McGurk, and Tom Lenderking, who's the special envoy on Yemen, that the focus will be Yemen and support for the truce. What is the real role that the conflict in Yemen plays now, and the role that Iran continues to play there and using it, I guess, as a threat over the Saudis, despite their supposed conciliation?
Well, at this point, I think the Saudis have decided that there's nothing much they can do to fix Yemen. So they folded and everything froze. And I think the Houthis, who are ruling Yemen together with Iran, have no ideas or have no structure in Yemen to fix things, to grow the economy, to reconstruct what was destroyed during the war. So the Saudis said, we're out. And the Iranians said, OK. But like you said, it's still a strategic threat, so to speak, to Saudi Arabia if Iran one day decides to use this Houthi card against the Saudis. And that's only in terms of military. Otherwise, it'll be as it is now, an isolated, destroyed country with no prospects and no economic growth.
My memory is that there were more than 20 million people in Yemen when the conflict started in the first decade of this century. Do we have any estimate of how many people remain, how many have fled, anything like that?
Well, I think the displaced and those who left the country is estimated in the millions. How many millions? I haven't seen any numbers. I'd say the population is still pretty much as it used to be because of the rapid growth, but it has not grown. I mean, of course, we don't have numbers, and there's no way of measuring the numbers of population since everyone is moving and many people were displaced and had to leave their houses over the past few years during the war.
Malcolm?
So what is your assessment right now of the much talked about Saudi U.S. negotiations with Israel, not with Israel, the Palestinians being involved in discussions in the last weeks? Where does that stand? And to what degree does domestic American politics play in the White House's decisions on going forward?
Well, it started as a regional issue, as a Saudi issue, and now it's become all U.S. partisan politics. And this started because Saudi Arabia decided to transform itself and its economy from one that relies on oil to one that relies on services and the global knowledge economy. And to do that, they had to change their relations with countries in the region, especially with vibrant economies like that of Israel. So the Saudis came to us and said, we don't think that the Palestinian issue is a priority anymore. They didn't say that we don't care about it, but they just said we have bigger priorities and we want to trade peace with Israel in return for other benefits to the Saudis. When the Biden administration joined this conversation, they turned a simple normalization deal between Saudi Arabia and Israel into what they call now a mega deal. And this has all sorts of stuff, including Saudi Arabia distancing itself from China, whether rightly or wrongly. But now it's much bigger deal, and the bigger it becomes, the harder the diplomacy behind it becomes. So what we know is that if you want a deal, a diplomatic deal done, it has to be simple. It's not this way anymore with this administration.
In Johannesburg, South Africa recently, the BRICS meeting invited Saudi Arabia and the UAE, among others, to join the BRICS. I was surprised, but at the same time, there's much observation that China's looking as an alternative to the G7 in some fashion. Has Saudi Arabia decided, has UAE decided to join the BRICS at the same time they maintain their relationship with NATO, with the U.S.?
Well, from time to time, Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries like to spite us, maybe to improve their position and to get better deals from Washington. But remember that BRICS perceive of themselves and introduce themselves as the global South. And Saudi Arabia and the UAE are two of the wealthiest monarchies in modern history. And the global South is certainly not their way of looking at global affairs. So while Saudi Arabia and the UAE have been really accommodating and nice and attended these conferences, including in Johannesburg, they have not really given their okay to join. The last statement that we heard from Faisal bin Farhan, the foreign minister of Saudi Arabia, after Saudi Arabia was invited to join BRICS as a member, he said, "Thank you for the invitation. We will consider it." He didn't say yes. So I think this is where things stand now. They'll continue to behave, to be nice toward China and BRICS. But at this point, I don't see them actually joining and abandoning the U.S. and NATO.
Malcolm?
Is the domestic considerations you mentioned earlier, in terms of American domestic politics, that the inclusion of the Palestinians will make it easier for those on the left and the inclusion of Israel easier for those on the center and right, about making a deal with Saudi Arabia, which is, you know, not popular amongst many members of Congress, and yet is very important to the U.S. So what is your sense on how this plays out and whether they, even if they got a deal, could Abbas really deliver?
Well, we're thinking about Saudi-Israeli normalization the way we think of what we call on Congress pork barrel. We're trying to put something for everyone in this deal. And this is not how diplomacy works. The Saudis came to Washington and said the Air Peace Initiative, which was approved in Beirut in 2002 and re-endorsed in Jeddah this year, the Air Peace Initiative says that these countries, their countries, will go to peace with Israel in return for a Palestinian state on the 1967 territories. Now, this condition of the Palestinian state has proven to be really complicated. There have been at least three peace offers: Clinton, Barack to Arafat, Obama, Olmert to Abbas, and a few other peace initiatives, and none of them worked. So the Saudis said, "Okay, since this is not working, here's an alternative. You, America, reassure us that you'll be our military allies, that you will sell us arms uninterrupted, and we will go to normalization with Israel." Now, this is not within the thinking of many in Congress, who some of them, at least in the Senate, have their biases, whether with or against Saudi Arabia. I think that if we go with the deal as originally imagined by the Saudis and the Israelis, without having the Palestinians as the centerpiece of this deal, I think it will or it can pass the House and the Senate. But it seems that this administration either doesn't share my opinion or don't want it to pass, and they want to add on top of it all these other demands, whether Palestinians or whether Saudi Arabia not denominating its sale of oil sale to China and the yuan. So all of these demands pile up on what was supposed to be a much easier, a much simpler normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel.
Hussein Abdul Hussein is a research fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, focusing on the Gulf, Malcolm Hohenlein, Conference of Presidents. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.